no weapons of mass destruction have been found. And so the war was based on information that was not true.
To me, the only way to live humanly is to disarm. And disarmament is a personal commitment, but it's got to translate into disarming my nation.
I'm 31 years old. I haven't got the first tooth in my head. I've lost all of my teeth. My memory is patchy at best.
The first Gulf War was classified as the most toxic battlefield that we'd ever fought on. So it's not unusual for me to believe that we're going to see significant health effects from that war.
We have to be extremely careful about our own language as peace activists. We all know that this war wasn't about liberation. The last thing the administration wants is a representative Iraqi government in Iraq.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, June 3rd, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A team of United Nations nuclear safety experts are being dispatched to Baghdad and are expected to arrive by the end of the week. The International Atomic Energy Agency says the team will be investigating whether nuclear material stored at the Tuwaitha nuclear complex is secure after being looted in the days following the U.S. invasion of Iraq. The U.S. and Britain invaded Iraq claiming that Saddam Hussein was harboring weapons of mass destruction in violation of a U.N. order following the 1991 Gulf War, but to date, no weapons have been found. Washington has tried to keep the IAEA out of Iraq in the aftermath of the war, but pressure from other countries has forced the U.S. to agree to its return. The team will be on a short leash. Only 10 or less members are allowed to go. Their stay should be no longer than 2 weeks, and the safety experts are forbidden from stepping foot inside Baghdad, where the U.N. inspectors were based before the war. Charges that the U.S. and Britain may have doctored evidence on Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction program were rejected again yesterday by Prime Minister Tony Blair. While attending the Group of Eight summit in Evian, France, Blair said, "I stand 100% behind the evidence based on intelligence that we presented the people." Both the U.S. and the U.K. were scrambling yesterday to explain why they have failed to unearth Iraq's weapons program. Secretary of State Colin Powell said it wasn't a figment of anyone's imagination that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction. There was no doubt in my mind as I went through the intelligence that the evidence was overwhelming. But Powell's statement seems to directly contradict an admission by British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw that he, Powell, President Bush, and British Prime Minister Tony Blair were all anxious to test the intelligence evidence. Articles in the London Guardian, the Christian Science Monitor, U.S. News and World Report magazine, and an upcoming piece in Vanity Fair magazine's July edition have all reported stories questioning the Bush administration's focus on alleged weapons of mass destruction as the justification for toppling the Iraqi regime because it was politically convenient. Today, Peace Watch talked with Ray McGovern, a 27-year CIA veteran and a member of the Steering Committee of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS. McGovern served as an all-intelligence agent during the Reagan White House.
The primary function of the Central Intelligence Agency is to be a central place for analysis of intelligence information from all sources, and that was my job, and it was an invigorating job. Lots of adrenaline there, a lot of responsibility, and during my later years with the agency, and I spent 27 years doing these kinds of things, I was privileged to brief what we call the President's Daily Brief, which involves a one-on-one with the Vice President, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and the Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs. Now, we worked in teams, so I didn't do every one of those every morning. It was every other morning where I would cover two or three of those, and we had our regular clients. Mm-hmm. So most often I was briefing Vice President Bush, Secretary Schultz, and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Vesey.
Which is why we thought it would be appropriate to talk with you about this situation. On February 5th, U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell presented a 75-minute theatrical speech, one might say, discussing what was described as declassified information about evidence of Iraq's alleged weapons program, that it allegedly had weapons of mass destruction. However, prior to that speech, and according to a London news agency source, Powell and his British counterpart Jack Straw had a private meeting at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel where they both collaborated on their uneasiness over the lack of evidence and the claims being made by President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair on Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction. Are you familiar with this story of this meeting?
I am. I am, and I'm not at all surprised. They did well to be uneasy about the status of the intelligence because it was very fragile, very flimsy, and very cooked.
We're told that Straw said the problem was the lack of corroborative evidence to back up the weapons of mass destruction claims, and the transcripts further quoted Powell as saying he was apprehensive about intelligence assessments containing circumstantial evidence and telling Straw he hoped the facts, when they came out, would not explode in their faces. How significant is this?
Well, it's significant in as much as the facts have exploded in their faces. No weapons of mass destruction have been found. There certainly are no weapons of mass destruction justifying what the President of the United States described as a, quote, grave danger, end quote, to U.S. national security. And so the war was based on information that was not true, information that was fed to our congressmen and representatives, our representatives and our senators, in an attempt to get them to approve a war, which they ended up doing. And for the first time in our country's history, we launched a war without being provoked.
Well, can you tell us more about what you've heard about this actual meeting that took place? How agitated did Colin Powell get? We've heard various accounts.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing about Colin Powell. He's the good soldier, the epitome of the martinet, the good soldier. He owes his whole identity to his service to the military and to the nation, president as commander-in-chief. And so he is going to say whatever the commander-in-chief tells him to say. Now, he knew he was arguing a very flimsy brief, and we wrote that same day, we veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, we wrote a critique, an evaluation of what Colin Powell said in a memorandum for the president. In it, we gave him an A for performance and a C-plus for content. His presentation did not bear close scrutiny, as has been shown by subsequent events.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one thing I would add is that there was a really interesting little report that escaped attention in the mainstream press, but it was actually carried on a rather conservative web page. And it reported on a meeting that Powell had with all the U.S. ambassadors to NATO countries in January. And in the corridor after this meeting, one of our ambassadors approached the secretary and said to Secretary Powell, what about the evidence? What about the evidence for these weapons of mass destruction? And he, according to this report, said, you know, I haven't seen it yet. And that was January.
Hmm.
Now, he...
Late January?
Don't recall. But he is in receipt of the president's daily brief every morning, just as I described my function back in the 80s. So if he hadn't seen evidence of weapons of mass destruction, there's something basically wrong. You recall that he describes himself right before February 5th as spending 4 days and four nights poring over the evidence. Well, that's a little late, you know. That's a little late. And it was run by not the CIA, but the NSC. So we had a policy agency running the collection, such as it was, of intelligence, such as it was, for the Secretary's speech.
You say, you describe Secretary of State Colin Powell as a good soldier. Does that explain, in your opinion, why in the face of reports that, or frustration that the details in the report were not corroborated and were from a single source, as an intelligence professional, is it normal procedure to base intelligence on a single uncorroborated source?
No, it's not, but there are exceptions. Let me just provide a little historical context here. When an American president wants to go to war and the intelligence doesn't support that wish, the intelligence is either manufactured or it's cooked. Now, This is not particularly a Republican problem. It's a bipartisan activity. And all we need do is refer back to Vietnam when Lyndon Johnson, knowing that no incident had occurred in the Tonkin Gulf the last day, nevertheless seized on the initial press reports of this and decided that this was his opportunity to get Congress to approve his war. Now, there was a very poignant report. McNeil Lehrer had McGeorge Bundy, who was Johnson's national security advisor. They had him on right after McNamara was doing his confession about Vietnam, and they asked him about the Tonkin Gulf, and they said, didn't you know that the evidence was not there, that there was no evidence of a second attack? And Mac Bundy said, yeah, I did. Well, didn't you tell the president? Yeah, I did. Well, what did he say? He said, are you going to help me sell this thing to Congress or not? And so I did. Now, Mac Bundy was no slouch. I mean, he had been president at Harvard University, after all. And yet, at that level, total power corrupts, and you're very, very, very disinclined to go against the team or to not appear to be serving the president. Now, there's a direct analogy between that and what Colin Powell, the position that he was in early this year. Mm-hmm. What are the alternatives? Well, the alternatives is to have enough integrity to quit or to threaten to quit and stem this insanity. He was not capable of doing either, and I think it sort of is explained by his... Well, I know Colin Powell. I saw him every other morning for 2 years, mm-hmm. and he also grew up in my neighborhood in the Bronx, and we were a year apart in ROTC, so I think I have a good beat on the man, and I admire his deep convictions, but I do not admire the way he sublimates those to his commander-in-chief.
Mm-hmm. So the executive branch, it sounds as though you're saying historically and bipartisanly, don't allow the facts to get in the way of the truth.
Not once a decision has been made to make war.
Former CIA agent Ray McGovern is on the steering committee of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. He was also responsible for the briefing of the president and his cabinet during the Reagan years. Baghdad was the site of a mass protest earlier today as thousands of Muslims marched from a large mosque to the headquarters of the U.S. authorities running the city, chanting "Down, down, America, down, down, Saddam," and holding a banner reading "Saddam and America are two faces on the same coin." They threatened violence unless U.S. forces withdraw from the country, and they expressed anger over the military's policy of body searching women at checkpoints throughout the city. For decades, Iraqis have witnessed the foreign policy of Saddam Hussein's government, and they've seen the deterioration of the Ba'athist ideology. Through its motto of unity, socialism, and liberty, it aimed at unifying the Arab world into a unique nation. Today, most Iraqis, and especially Kurds and Shias, feel that the promotion of pan-Arabism by Saddam Hussein has been done at their expense. Under constant repression, Iraqis feel they've been the victims of this ideology. A mixture of anger, jealousy, and sometimes racism is expressed by many who feel Saddam Hussein gave a false image of himself in Iraq. What has resulted is a distinction among Iraqis between themselves and other Arabs, and a strengthening of Iraqi nationalism. Raphael Kraft reports from Baghdad and Babylon.
The megaphone is placed on the covered wire fencing surrounding Haifa camp in Baghdad's Al-Ariya neighborhood. On the lawn, yellowing with the sun, nearly 100 tents have been erected by the Iraqi Red Crescent Society to welcome Palestinian families. There is a feeling of déjà vu when looking at what resembles a picture from the 1948 archives of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. Some say they are the victims of the war. Sadiq Murtada was born in Baghdad. He worked as a tailor, but he now lives in a tent.
I was living in a flat in the Al-Ariya neighborhood. This flat was rented to the owner by the government. I didn't know the price of the rent. After the fall of Baghdad, the owner came to us and gave us a week to pack up and leave. So we left and came here.
Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist regime required Iraqi flat owners to rent their spaces to Palestinians and foreign Arab nationals at affordable rates. For most Palestinians in the camp, The fall of the regime is considered a great loss for their cause. As in Gaza and the West Bank, many Palestinians here had seen hope in Saddam Hussein's army to liberate Jerusalem, and they remember the 39 Scud missiles he ordered launched on Israel during the first Gulf War in 1991. On the wall of his office nearby the camp, Anwar Salem al-Houdeh, head of the Iraqi Red Crescent Society, has kept a photo of Yasser Arafat and Saddam Hussein greeting each other.
Really, we have a good relationship with the previous government in Iraq. And this is for the history. You cannot bury the history for complete. We have a lot of many pictures and different pictures with our president and the president of Iraq, the previous president of Iraq. As we have many pictures of Mr. Arafat, Yasser Arafat, our president, with many presidents of the world. And it's part of history.
But Falah Hassan, an Islamic journalist, poet and writer, has bitter feelings about Iraqi-Palestinian relations, including the relationship between Yasser Arafat with Saddam Hussein. He never believed in what he called Saddam Hussein's rhetoric on the Palestinian cause.
We realized since the beginning that Saddam Hussein was showing great attention towards the Palestinian people. He has tried to tap into the main Arab sentiments with long speeches and rhetoric, but an honest man cannot behave in two different ways. On the one hand, causing mass graves here in Iraq, and on the other hand, expressing the will to liberate the people in Palestine. While he was giving 10,000 U.S. dollars to the families of Palestinian suicide bombers, he was asking Iraqi families to pay for the bullets that were used to kill their own relatives. I think he has cheated the Palestinians. He never led them to peace, nor has he enabled them to fight for their liberation. I repeat, he is a cheater. He was supporting Hamas, while at the same time he was supporting Yasser Arafat.
At the Hilla Babylon mass grave, an old woman just found her son among the hundreds of bags filled with bones lying in the heat. Most of the 11,000 bodies discovered here were victims of Saddam Hussein's repression of the 1991 Shia uprising. Nearby, Mohi Nasser Hussein, a 50-year-old convenience store owner, is looking for the remnants of his cousin. He's angry at the press.
What we have to tell the press is that when Saddam Hussein was ruling, the Arab channels were concentrating all their attention all the time, every day at length, to Mohammed Adoura, the young Palestinian kid killed on television at the beginning of the Palestinian Intifada. Here, where we are now, there are thousands of dead bodies, and no such attention was given to them by the media.
Like Mohi Nasser Hussein, Father Yusuf, the head of the Dominican Priest's Convent in Baghdad, is questioning all the attention given to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in recent Middle East history. But can tragedies be compared?
The Palestinian tragedy has been amplified compared to the suffering of the Iraqi people. I am ready to say that what Iraq has experienced under Saddam Hussein has been far more grave than what the Palestinians have lived in their camps under Israeli occupation. This is something that all Iraqis have understood. They should stop paying for something they are far away from. We cannot only share adversity.
Bitterness is not solely oriented toward the Palestinians, but towards all non-Iraqi Arabs. Arab volunteers who came to fight the Americans in Iraq were not welcomed by a population that saw them as defenders of the regime. At Mustansuria University, most of the 100 non-Iraqi students have left. The animosity, not to say the racism, expressed by the Iraqi students is reminiscent of the attitudes of Eastern European students toward foreign communist students after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. Nadim is studying biology at Mustansuria University in Baghdad.
I never talked to them. I never liked them. I never had any Arabic friends, basically. I've only met one of them. And I really wanted to tell them that to f*** off, basically. I know that most of them were members of the Ba'ath Party. And that thing really is bothering us Iraqi people because we don't like Ba'ath Party. Just that they were benefiting a lot from the Saddam Hussein regime. And that was all from our money, Iraqi people.
The Iran-Iraq war lasted 7 years and killed more than 1 million people. Iraqis rightly compare it to the First World War, as every town and family of Iraq experienced their own losses. It was presented to both the Iraqis and the rest of the Arab world as a war to counter Persian invasion of the region. But unlike the First World War, Arab immigrant workers, rather than women, filled the vacuum left in the factories by the Iraqi men called to the front line. After the war, massacres encouraged by the regime killed dozens of Egyptian immigrants. Karim Hussein was a French-trained Mirage fighter pilot during the war before being shot down above Iran in 1987. Since he returned from 4 years of captivity in an Iranian POW camp, he says he feels betrayed.
J'ai perdu pas mal des amis à moi.
In this war, I have lost many friends and relatives, but all we have lost is for nothing. The regime may have gained something, but we fought a war for nothing. Today, we start to understand the story. The Iraqis paid a high price for the Arabs. We have lost so many people because of the Kuwaitis, because of the Jordanians, because of the Saudis. Some thanks to the Arabs. Myself, I am an Iraqi, not an Arab.
As Father Yusuf, back at the Dominican Priest Convent, explains, Iraqi nationalism is strong today.
Iraqi nationalism exists, I am surprised to say, and it is very strong and very positive. It is shared by many people, many intellectuals. It is even shared by Shia and Kurdish leaders. We do not want to be involved in trans-border endeavors like pan-Kurdism or pan-Arabism. The banning of the Ba'ath Party means an end to this ideology that promoted the unity of Arab countries. But for 35 years, what we did only destroyed this unity.
Is this general sentiment circumstantial? Will it be tempered with time by the Sunni community of Iraq, who feels closer to the mostly Sunni Arab world? Will Iraq look eastward toward Persia? Will this sentiment have any effect on the future relationship with Israel? At last, is this sentiment shared by other repressed communities in the Arab world, like Shias from Saudi Arabia and the rest of the Persian Gulf? Before the American-led war on Iraq, Jordan tried to promote a Jordan-first slogan to incite its population to concentrate on its national interest instead of looking at both the neighboring Palestinian and Iraqi crisis. It was artificial. Today, for the best or the worst, it could work in Iraq. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, this is Raphael Kraft in Baghdad.
Closer to home, as hundreds of civilians were touring battleships in New York Harbor on May 25th, four peace activists calling themselves the Riverside Plowshares threw their own blood and hammered on missile launch hatches on the deck of the guided missile cruiser, the USS Philippine. The ship was the first U.S. Navy vessel to launch missiles at Afghanistan during the war in 2001. The participants, Brian Buckley of Virginia, Mark Colville of Connecticut, Joan Gregory of New York, and Sister Susan Clarkson of the United Kingdom, are all members of Catholic workers' communities. Although the four were arrested briefly, they were not charged, and after a few hours, they were released by authorities. According to a history of Plowshares peace actions, which date back to the 1980s, more than 150 people have participated in at least 70 similar actions in several countries that have targeted a range of weapons and weapon delivery systems. They have served prison terms averaging 1 or 2 years, but the longest sentence was 18 years. It appears that this is the first Plowshares action in the U.S. in which participants were not charged with a crime, although activists in a similar protest in 1987 aboard a ship in Sydney Harbor, Australia, were not charged. A spokeswoman for the New York Police Department says since no charges were filed, she has no information on the incident. Melinda Tuhus spoke to participant Mark Colville at his home in New Haven, Connecticut. After his release from custody in New York City, he describes the incident and his philosophy of nonviolent resistance.
As soon as we started pouring the blood, these sailors backed away and backed the rest of the crowd away. And so they basically left us alone. We had been concerned that, you know, obviously they were armed. There were armed guards patrolling the ship. We weren't sure what their reaction would be. There was a lot of professionalism exhibited by the sailors on the ship. They didn't mishandle us at all.
How many minutes were you kneeling there? You were displaying pictures, you were praying, you were also talking, some of you were talking directly to the crowd.
Yeah, I think my estimate would be 15 to 20 minutes we were there. The sailors had pretty much surrounded us, but again, they were backed off, and it wasn't until officers of the ship came that we were finally arrested. The sailors were telling all of the people to ignore us. They said, just ignore them, and they were trying to show people the other weapons on the ship. It was kind of bizarre, but our friend Joan picked up on that, and Joan started addressing the people directly and saying, no, you can't ignore us. Pointing to the pictures, she said, this is what these weapons do. You can't close your eyes to this. You know, the blood is real. People were staring at us as the tour went on. They were still within 10 or 20 yards of us, and people were obviously distracted and looking at us. There were in the crowd, there were many children, which is very problematic for me in terms of how war is indoctrinated into our kids, almost without even noticing it. As we bring up children, they get indoctrinated into the normalcy of war. Our bottom line is nonviolence, and yet we need to bring the blood that is shed by these weapons back to the site from where they're launched, so that the people who launch them can see it. And not only the people who launch them. I mean, in this day and age, in terms of war, people who pay taxes for war are just as directly connected to it as the people who press these buttons. You know, to the sailors, it's a video game, you know, and they never see, underline never see, the results of what they're doing. And it's the same for us who pay taxes.
You were there longer than you expected, and eventually some higher-ups from the military came and escorted you off the ship. And then I think you were kind of surprised by what happened later in the day, right?
Yeah, so actually we were arrested right there on the ship and handcuffed behind our backs and made to stand there for a good half an hour before we were escorted off the ship. They brought us down the same way we came up, and so there was a large crowd of people who watched us being paraded down into a waiting van, and we were roundly booed by most of them, as you might imagine. We were expecting to be brought to jail, and we ended up sitting on the van for about 3 hours as there appeared to be some dispute between the police department and the federal agents about who was going to arrest us or hold us or what charges would be filed. The end result of all that was that I guess about 3 hours later we were told that we were going to be released.
Do you have any idea why you weren't charged?
It would be pure speculation on my part, but I am aware that there was a Plowshares action done in Colorado recently, for which 3 Catholic nuns were recently convicted, and they're awaiting sentencing in July. They're facing a minimum, as I understand it, a minimum of 6.5 years in prison. This has been big news, and so we think that maybe New York didn't want that kind of publicity coming up, particularly during Fleet Week. But that's just speculation. When you do these actions, you never know what the reaction's going to be. And so we were obviously shocked that we were released without charge.
You know, within the peace movement, there have been people who have criticized the Plowshares actions. Some people think they're violent. They involve throwing blood around. Or they think they're too draining on the movement's resources. Or they say they're ineffective because they're only symbolic. You served about a year in prison for another Plowshares action in 1997, so you weren't going into this naively. Why do you, Mark Colville, participate in these actions?
It's clear to me that that our efforts for peace have to go beyond simple protest. Whenever our empire decides it's going to fight another war, we tend to hit the streets by the thousands and sometimes by the millions. And that's a beautiful thing. And yet our protest has got to translate into some kind of positive action. And I can think of no more positive action than the people taking the responsibility that governments are refusing to take, which is to disarm. Disarmament has got to happen if we're going to stop the next war. Disarmament's gonna has got to happen if we're going to pass on a world to the next generation, as far as I'm concerned, as a parent with six kids. And for me, what I do in terms of both protest, involvement in the peace movement, and which is all an outgrowth of my Catholic faith, I've got to find ways to live humanly in this context. You know, as far as I'm concerned, my name is on those weapons. Those weapons are built with the express purpose of securing me. To me, the only way to live humanly is to disarm, and disarmament is a personal commitment, and but it's got to translate into disarming my nation. And that, to me, I mean, I'm not about, my commitment in the peace movement doesn't stop at protest. You know, my no has to contain a yes, and the yes is a disarmed world, which I'm willing to join with other people, forming small communities and going forward with that process.
Mark Colville is a member of the New Haven, Connecticut Catholic worker community and a member of the Riverside Plowshares. He spoke with Peace Watch correspondent Melinda Tuhus. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.